There was a time around the year 2003, before e-books and e-readers, when it seemed that everywhere you turned, in an airport, on a bus, anywhere people read, people were reading The Kite Runner. It was an epic tale set in Afghanistan, and it sold more than 7 million copies in the U.S. and was translated into over 40 languages. It catapulted the man who wrote it, Khalid Hosseini, onto the global literary stage. Hosseini followed that success with another about his homeland, A Thousand Splendid Sons. That, too, became a bestseller. And now, 6 years later, he has written another heart-wrenching tale. Yes, it is also set in Afghanistan, but the narrative extends to California, Paris, even the Greek islands. Khalid Hosseini joins me now from Stanford, California. Welcome to the program, Mr. Hosseini.
Hi, Rachel. How are you?
I'm well. Nice to have you on the show. At its core, your latest book is really a story about family, one family in particular. And the tale begins with a couple of characters named Abdullah and Perry. Can you introduce us to them?
Yeah, it begins in 1952. Abdullah and Perry. Abdullah is 10, Perry is 3. And they're living in a remote and impoverished village with their father and their stepmother and their baby stepbrother. And the family finds itself at a critical point. They've lost a baby to the winter the year before, and winter is around the corner again, and the family is desperate to survive the winter. And they're about to make a decision that's going to change the lives of these two characters, Abdullah and Perry. And it's this decision which ends up splitting the brother and sister, which then forms really the heart of the book.
I wonder if you could read us a passage from the book near the beginning. This is after this separation has occurred. Abdullah and Perry have been split up, and Abdullah is wishing he could just forget that he ever even knew her so that the pain would be lessened.
Abdullah would find himself on a spot where Perry had once stood, her absence like a smell pushing up from the earth beneath his feet, and his legs would buckle, and his heart would collapse in on itself. Perry hovered, unbidden, at the edge of Abdullah's vision everywhere he went. She was like the dust that clung to his shirt. She was in the silences that had become so frequent at the house. Silences that welled up between their words, sometimes cold and hollow, sometimes pregnant with things that went unsaid, like a cloud filled with rain that never fell. Some nights, he dreamed that he was in the desert again, alone, surrounded by the mountains, and in the distance, a single tiny glint of light flicking on, off, like a message.
There is a lot in this story about the power of memory and dreams, thoughts, how we try to control them, how we lose control, how those mental impressions shape our reality. What was it about that idea that captured your own imagination, made it into something you wanted to explore in this book?
Well, in some ways, I see the characters in this book, as with all of us in real life, as victims of the passage of time. And memory is the way with which we gauge that. So memory is a recurring theme in this book, and the question is raised a number of times about whether memory is a blessing, something that safeguards, you know, all the things that are dear to you, or is memory a curse, you know, something that makes you relive the most painful parts of your life, the toil, the struggle, the sorrows.
You've just introduced us to two of the central characters, these siblings, but from there you take the reader into the lives of a lot of other people in this family, connected directly and tangentially over a lifetime of experience, each story kind of feeding into the next. And as a reader, you're not really sure what's going to happen on the next page. When the next chapter comes, whose perspective will be revealed? Did the story just emerge to you that way, or was this a more deliberate decision?
It kind of happened that way as I wrote it. The novel began very, very small. And it began with a single image in my head that I simply could not shed. And it was the image of a man walking across the desert. And he's pulling a little radio flyer red wagon. And in it, there's a little girl, about 3, years old, and there's a boy walking behind him. And these three people are walking across the desert. And I had no idea who they were or why they were walking across the desert, what the story was behind them, what their dynamic was. And I sat down to explore that. And then it just kept snowballing. I began to see backstory, and I began to see how what happened to these three characters, particularly the little boy and the little girl, would have such profound impact, not only on their life, but on the lives of so many different characters. And I went and I listened to the voice of those other characters, and I went chasing them.
I would imagine it's also hard to know when to stop then, if you're always writing the next echo. How do you mm-hmm. know? How do you know when it's done? I know that's kind of a cliched question, but especially because of the way you've structured this, did it just feel finished?
No. I would love to go back and write two, three, or four, or five more, but at some point, somebody has to stop you. You know, and none of my novels feel finished to me. I mean, if I had my way, I'd go back and add and edit and take out and reshape. But at some point, you do have to stop.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Afghanistan, which is the mm-hmm. setting for your work. And Afghanistan's own political chaos, and particularly life under the Taliban, has been a central feature of your other two books. Mm-hmm. It is not the case with this story. I mean, there are references to it, but the narrative itself does not revolve around this.
No.
How did that come to be?
Part of it was, as I wrote the characters, it just kind of the way they came to me and the way they were shaped, their struggles turned out to be far more intimate and personal. I mean, often it had to do with loss of memory, of faculty, of love. And so the impact of the toil in Afghanistan is still there, but I think its effect on the lives of the characters is less resounding. I hope a day will come when we write about Afghanistan where we can speak about Afghanistan in a context outside of the wars and the struggles of the last 30 years. In some way, I think this book is an attempt to do that.
Your first book, The Kite Runner, is about fathers and sons, and A Thousand Splendid Sons, your second, is mostly about mothers and daughters. This book seems bigger. I mean, yes, there's the central relationship about Abdullah and Perry, the sibling relationship, and there are other siblings, but it extends to different kinds of relationships. Can you talk a little bit about this progression for you?
Well, I think at core, all three of my books have been love stories. And they haven't been traditional love stories in the sense that a romantic love story between a man and a woman. You know, there have been stories of love between characters where you would not expect love to be found. So it's always these intense relationships that form under very unexpected circumstances. And it's the same with this book. There are a number of instances where you have relationships between characters that are very intense and life-changing, and yet they're between people you would not expect it to happen. And for some reason, I'm drawn to that. I love writing about that. I'm not very interested in writing about sort of traditional romantic love, I think. You know, that's something that is in my books, but not one that I seem to be all that interested in.
What has this journey been like for yourself to have had these... Kite Runner was such this huge success and Thousand Splendid Sons after it. Do you put more pressure on yourself now to meet that standard every time?
I don't feel any pressure to be, quote-unquote, successful in economic or commercial or number of books sold and so on. The real angst comes from the very real possibility that one day I will sit and I will have nothing more to say, because I enjoy so much the process of writing, losing myself in another person's life and kind of going off to these imaginary places and looking up from the computer and 8 hours have passed and I have no idea where they went, and writing things that to me feel intimate and real and genuine. I don't take that for granted.
Khaled Hosseini, his latest novel is called And the Mountains Echoed. He joined us from Stanford, California. Mr. Hosseini, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Much appreciated.
You can find an excerpt of "And the Mountains Echoed" on our website, npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Robert Langdon is back. The Harvard art prof in custom tweeds and still wearing a Mickey Mouse watch wakes up in a hospital after getting grazed in the head by a bullet and wondering, how did I get to Florence? He's got a sinister artifact sewn into his coat and just a few hours to keep the world from a grim biological catastrophe. Dan Brown, whose The Da Vinci Code and Robert Langdon sequels have sold more than 200 million copies around the world, has written his first new novel in 4 years. It's a story that ranges around some of the most splendid urban scenery in Italy, sweeps a couple of learned beauties to his side, twists through a Dante code, and raises questions in Latin, Italian, and English about how the human species can keep going. I'm out of breath, and we haven't even introduced the author. Dan Brown's new novel is Inferno. He joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
What a wonderful synopsis. Thanks for having me.
I have to ask, do you think you have some kind of formula for writing bestsellers?
Well, I wish I did. I could write them a lot faster. They all have certainly similar elements. There's codes and symbols and beautiful locations. But no, I don't have a formula that I know of.
What drew you to Dante for this book? A great artist, but not considered to be a source of mirth, if I might put it that way.
No, the comedy many say is misnamed. But I have written a lot about the fine arts, but I'd never written about the literary arts, and so on some level, Dante really spoke to me as new ground, but also familiar ground. Like the Mona Lisa, the Divine Comedy is one of those great art. Sort of human artistic achievements that it transcends its moment in history and becomes a cultural touchstone. Feels very perfect ground for Robert Langdon.
Is the research you did through some of the most dramatic and enchanting spots in Italy as much damn fun as it sounds?
I hate to say this. It is. It's a blast. It's kind of a catch-22 now because, since the Da Vinci Code, I have access to places and people that I didn't have access to before. So that's a lot of fun for somebody like me. But I'm always trying to keep a secret. Yeah. I don't want people to know what I'm writing about. So I often end up asking, half of the questions I ask are about something totally unrelated. And half of the places I go see are unrelated, just trying to keep people off the track of what I'm writing about.
You have a villain, and I think I can safely call him a villain in this book, named Bertrand Zobrist.
You may certainly call him a villain.
Okay. evil genius. And because he is an evil genius, he has a way of saying things that sometimes sound very worthwhile. Where does this character come from?
Well, in any novel, you would hope that the hero has someone to push back against. And villains, I find the most interesting villains those who do the right things for the wrong reasons or the wrong things for the right reasons. Either one is interesting. I love the gray area between right and wrong. Here is somebody who says we have an enormous population problem on this planet, and everybody's turning a blind eye, and there are no simple solutions, but there is a solution. And while it's terrifying, maybe there's a silver lining to it. Maybe he's actually the good guy in all this.
Mm. I don't want to give anything away, but you suggest that there are scientists who genuinely believe that a virus could actually be a good way of delivering mass immunization against vicious diseases.
Yes. It was fascinating. As I was researching this book, I talked to a number of doctors and read an enormous amount on viruses and genetic engineering and all sorts of things. And what I heard everywhere from everyone was the genetic toolbox is so powerful that there really is nothing we can't do. I would say, can we do this? Can we do that? Absolutely, we can. And finally, they just stop me and say, look, anything you can dream of doing to the human species, we can now do. The only thing that stops us is money and ethics.
I think if I have a favorite line in this book, it's when Robert Langdon asks his publisher to loan him the corporate jet. So he can, after all, save the world, more or less.
Yes.
And his editor says, I'm not going to lend our jet to someone who writes art books. If you want to write 50 Shades of Iconography, we can talk. So where does this come from?
Well, you know, this character, Jonas Faulkman, the editor, is loosely based, or not so loosely based, on my editor, Jason Kaufman. It's an anagram, as many people know.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my position, you see a lot of the politics of publishing companies, and it's fascinating. And I've often thought that I would love to write a book set in a publishing company. They're fascinating worlds, and that's just a little glimpse inside.
Yeah, but the turnover has gotten so big these days, hasn't it?
Things
Once you
are
write
changing.
About a character, yeah.
Yeah, things are changing rapidly.
The joke about 50 Shades of Iconography you have here does kind of raise the question about where you see yourself fitting into the literary landscape. Now, as we speak, can I put it this way respectfully, because I enjoyed the book, your book has gotten great reviews for a Dan Brown book.
I guess that's one way to put it. You know, it's funny. I don't know where I would place myself in the literary landscape. I really just write the book that I would want to read. And I put on the blinders and it is for me that simple. I'm somebody who likes codes and ciphers and chases and artwork and architecture and all the things that you find in a Robert Langdon thriller.
Dan Brown, his new novel, Inferno. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
American institutions, from government to Wall Street to small-town Rotary clubs, have broken down. That's what journalist George Packer says in a new book. It's called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where he often covers the political scene. His book, The Assassin's Gate, took him to the streets of Baghdad in the middle of the Iraq War. But Packer's new book looks at the last few turbulent decades of life here in America and profiles some of the most famous and successful Americans, as well as people you've probably never heard of, a community organizer, a local entrepreneur, a disenchanted Washington lobbyist. Packer weaves these profiles together to tell a larger story about this moment in America, a moment, he says, in which the country has lost something vital.
I think of it as a deal that used to exist among Americans, a deal that maybe lasted half a century, from the 30s to the late 70s, in which everyone had a place. People were more constrained than they are today. They had less freedom, but they had more security. And there was a sense in which each generation felt that the next generation would be able to improve itself, to do better, and that there were channels of opportunity, education, jobs, that would allow people's children to rise. And I think over the last generation, that deal has come undone. And instead, many Americans feel that they're all alone, that no one is going to help them, and that in a way there's a kind of unfairness at play in our society where elites seem to do better and better, and ordinary people who might have once even thought of themselves as middle class struggle more and more. That's what's unwound in my adult lifetime.
You just outlined a pretty dire situation. Did you start to hone in on this theme, this idea of an unwinding, purely from the financial institution meltdown of 2008, or was there something else that you were seeing that led you to this place?
You know, I think it began with the Iraq War. I covered Iraq for The New Yorker. I wrote a book about it. And I'd begun by seeing that war as a failure of individual leaders. But over time, I saw that whole institutions were failing. The military at the beginning of the war failed. Intelligence, the media failed. And then the financial crisis made it seem as if there was something epical going on. And that's when I began to think, how would I write about a country that is watching its core institutions collapse? I wanted to do it as a narrative. I wanted to pull together stories of Americans whose lives have kind of moved to the pulse of this recent history. And so I went about the country trying to find people whose stories fit in with that larger narrative.
Which you do. You include a wide variety of vignettes and profiles of Americans. Some of them are famous, Newt Gingrich, Oprah Winfrey, but you also write about people who are just Americans. One character in particular, a woman named Tammy Thomas. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, Tammy was born, raised, and still lives in Youngstown, Ohio. She's African American. She grew up during a time when Youngstown was a steel town, and it was a union town. But around the time she was a teenager, the steel mills just collapsed one after another in rapid succession. And Youngstown collapsed with them so quickly that it became a kind of icon of deindustrialization. And I spent a lot of time with Tammy driving around the city, looking at the landmarks of her life and hearing her story, which was an incredible story of a woman who her mother was a heroin addict. She was not close to her father. She had three children without their fathers really being in their lives. But she got a job in an auto parts factory, and that allowed her to raise the kids and to hold herself and them together amid an absolutely disastrous situation in Youngstown. And then, around the time of the financial crisis and the election of Barack Obama, having lost her job because the auto parts factory went bankrupt, she remade herself as a community organizer, and that's what she's doing now. She has not given up on Youngstown, and I think even though these institutions are collapsing and people do feel they're on their own, the individuals in the book, people like Tammy and Dean Price, who maybe we can talk about from North Carolina, there's a resilience and even an optimism that's kind of remarkable given what's going on around them.
You mentioned Dean Price. He's from North Carolina, tobacco country. How does his story fit into the larger narrative that you're telling?
Well, I've never been anywhere that felt so old and so traditionally American as the Carolina Piedmont, which is the region that Dean comes from. It's tobacco country. There used to be textiles and furniture making. And then tobacco, as we know, fell with the 90s and the investigations and the tobacco buyout. And it kind of laid waste to what had been a very intact middle class and working class part of the country. Dean Price is a son of that region. His father was a Bible Belt preacher. His whole family had been tobacco farmers since the 18th century. They all lived within about 10 miles of each other in Rockingham County, North Carolina. And again, around the time of the financial crisis, Dean, who had this truck stop business, watched his business fail. So he turned to biofuels. And he has this whole vision, which I think is a very American vision, of a resurgence, a kind of renaissance of the countryside through alternative energy. But he's doing it on his own. No one is telling him to. There's no organization he's part of. There's no union or business trade association or newspaper that he's connected. He's a loner out there. He's a Johnny Appleseed spreading biodiesel across the countryside.
But I could imagine some people would say, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what America's about. You articulate a dream, a goal, and you go do it. And sometimes you have to do it alone.
That's true. It's a very deep American dream. It's not the only American dream. There's also a dream of being part of a community. And it's the dissolution of these communities that's so painful to see. Because as Dean said to me while we were walking around Madison, North Carolina, the town that he grew up in, the shoe store was closed down. The pharmacy was shuttered. The restaurants were closed. There were just a couple people on the sidewalk. You see this in little towns all across the heartland. He said the guys who used to own those stores were the pillars of this community. They coached the Little League teams. They were on the town council. They're gone. And communities can't suffer that way without great consequences.
Is this just another part of a cycle, or is this unwinding as you see it different?
In some ways, it is cyclical. I think we've been through it many times before. So I don't want to say this is it. You know, we'll never come back from this. We've come back before. We've often come back stronger. What I see happening is not just cyclical, though. It feels like a real cultural shift where the value of the community, of what makes this a coherent society, has really been submerged. And it's not all dark. We've been talking as if it's a completely dismal picture. But what isn't dark is the energy and the vitality and the humor and the dreams, as well as the screw-ups and the setbacks of the characters in the book. When I stop thinking about the big picture and institutions and leaders, and I think about these people who I got to know so well, they still give me hope.
The book is called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. George Packer joined us in our studios in Washington. Thank you so much, George.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The writer Chimamanda Adichie has long been exceeding expectations. She was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2008. 2 years later, The New Yorker named her to its list of the best writers under the age of 40. But reviewer Rosecrans Baldwin says Adichie's newest book didn't live up to his expectations.
There are a lot of books about coming of age in America. What we don't have as many of, and what we need, are books about coming of age in America as an immigrant, because there are things that natives can't see that stand out like neon to foreign eyes. In Americana, a young Nigerian woman, Ifemelu, moves to the U.S. for school, leaving behind her boyfriend and family. It's a story about relocation and about far-flung love, but it's also about being a stranger in a new culture, lonely, but at the same time privileged. If you read Adichie's previous novel, Half of a Yellow Sun, you'll remember the electricity of her writing. That book won the Orange Prize 6 years ago, and it's so good, I'm still pressing it on friends and strangers. Americana's first chapters, which are set mostly in Nigeria, have a similar crackle. Adichie describes a party at a rich man's house. She writes of some aspirational guests. They were wearing the uniform of the Lagos youngish and wealthy-ish. Leather slippers, jeans, and open-neck tight shirts, all with familiar designer logos. But there was, in their manner, the plowing eagerness of men in need. After Ifemelu lands in the U.S., she becomes, among other things, a blogger. She writes funny, punchy updates about black life in America, from hairstyles to politics. But the writing falls surprisingly flat when she's experiencing life offline. We get explanations instead of action. There's discourse, but little drama. And some weak writing does sneak through. One character is described as wearing the pashmina of the wounded. But ultimately, when Ifemelu returns to Lagos, Adichie writes that the heaps of rubbish rose on the roadsides like a taunt. Commerce thrummed too defiantly. The novel's flaws aside, it's that type of evocative power that has me looking forward to her books for years to come.
That was Rosecrans Baldwin. His latest book is called Paris, I Love You, But You're Bringing Me Down. He reviewed the novel Americana by Chimamanda Adichie.
On the night of October 19, 1984, Eric Vogel was uneasy about flying, but the young pilot was behind schedule, and he felt like his job was on the line. So he took off, as he did most days, shuttling between remote communities dotting the Canadian wilderness.
It was snowing. The de-icer didn't work. The autopilot didn't work. And his co-pilot had been bumped to fit one more passenger on the 10-seater plane.
And in the middle of that, he's hearing these chunks of ice coming off the props and banging like rocks against the fuselage. And he made a calculation error. He thought he was past the high point, but there was another rise of land, 2,500 feet, and he hit that top of that rise. So it was a miracle that anyone got out of that plane alive.
Carol Shaben is the author of a book about that crash, a book called Into the Abyss. Six people were killed. Shaben's own father, a politician named Larry Shaben, survived along with three others, the pilot Eric Vogel, a prisoner named Paul Archambault, and the police officer escorting him.
Scott Deschamps was that Canadian Mountie. The moment before impact sticks with him all these years later.
If you're driving down the road in a car and you run off into the rough for a second, mm-hmm. you hear that, and you pull back onto the road. And that's what I heard. Just for a second, something rough. And I remember thinking, the plane's not supposed to do that. And before I could even finish that thought, maybe a few seconds later, I just remember everything breaking apart. And that's the last I remember of the crash.
Okay, we now know the plane crashed through a bank of trees. And then as the fuselage plowed into the ground, upside down, broken bits of plane sheared off the roof, peeled open like a sardine can. But when Scott Deschamps opened his eyes, he only knew that he was trapped, partly buried in the ground.
Then I felt someone tugging on my foot. And it was Paul. And he had found me. He had come back to the plane to find me. And there was great agony with him pulling off chunks of plane before he even got to the dirt that encased me. And I was completely disoriented. And I didn't know where I was or what had happened. And it took me probably 10 minutes before I realized the plane had crashed. And I can remember sitting in the plane. I remember looking out the open, broken fuselage at the snow falling. And in the far distance, I could see the glow of a fire. And we got by the fire, and that's where we sat most of the night.
So Paul managed to start a fire. Yeah. It's extremely cold. You're in the wilderness. And as I'm reading this, I begin thinking about Jack London's To Build a Fire. A guy's desperate to build a fire, and if he fails, he's going to die. And then as I'm reading your account, well, the fire goes out. You run out of fuel. What was going through your mind then?
Mm. There's a forest of trees. Trees, trees everywhere, but not a branch to burn. And that's the truth. You have no axe. You have no way of gathering wood. You can't find fallen wood because there's 3.5 feet of snow. And we sent Paul on a constant vigilance for anything that would burn. Fire was life, Steve. Fire was life. And at different times during the night, we had no fire. And I'd been on many search and rescue situations as a Mountie where you'd go into these camps looking for lost hunters or motor vehicle accidents in the back bush. And you find the people eventually, but you find them as frozen corpses. And I figured that's how we would be found.
Of course you were found in the end, just in time. The four of you survived. And Carol Shaben, I'd like to know how people's lives changed after that incident.
Well, Steve, each of these survivors was completely transfigured by what had happened that night. And all of their lives took sharp turns, if you will. Paul Archambault, who had a long prison record, who, you know, was an accused criminal, a drifter who'd been drifting across the country since he was 15 or 16. He went back, he got on a plane 2 days later and faced charges, faced a judge in court, and the judge said, "You are to be commended for your actions, and I exonerate you of all charges." Hmm. So this ne'er-do-well vagabond, who'd had nothing but hard luck, was all of a sudden hailed as a hero. So it took a dramatic turn that way.
What about your father?
My dad was changed. He was a changed man. He began to look at his life and judge his worth as a man from that point forward by what he accomplished in the years, the extra years he felt he got that others on that plane did not. And he felt like the political life that he had been living, it wasn't enough. He needed to do more. And he floundered for a long time trying to figure out what that was. And after 9/11, he became very, very strident about trying to build bridges across cultures, trying to increase understanding and tolerance. And my dad created this incredible philanthropic life and this incredible legacy that I think was a greater tribute than his 16 years of political career.
Scott Deschamps, how did this event change you?
Well, Steve, I made a bucket list before bucket lists were made. I had a very profound list of things I wanted to do if I was ever going to get off that mountain. And you know, there's 10 things, and I just finished them. It took me 25 years to finally finish the last one.
What were some of the things on the list?
One of the things that most profound, and I voiced it at the time, was the fact that I was going to die on that stupid mountain, and I never had a family. So I went forward very specifically to be a great parent, and I am. I have two wonderful children. I'd never been to university. So when I left the Mounted Police, I did a bachelor's degree, and then I went on and I did a master's degree. And I had a whole bunch of other things. Now I live in peace, and life is good.
Carol Shaben, is the author of Into the Abyss, the story of four plane crash survivors. Scott Deschamps was one of those survivors. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Greene.